How to Stage the Counter-Coup. We the people can start a groundswell that will eventually topple the Bush-Cheney junta. With a commitment of only a couple hours a week, here's how. Number one, contact your representatives on a weekly basis and get three friends to do the same. Senators, members of Congress, and other elected officials pay careful attention to the calls, letters, and telegrams they receive. Each day, they receive a tally of their constituents' messages. Take just a few minutes each week and let your thoughts be known. The Bush agenda can be brought to a grinding halt by a public outcry, and even a few hundred letters can constitute an outcry. Several Bush policies have already been shelved after public disapproval. It works. We all whine too much. Why not put it to good use? Pick an issue you care about and do the following today. A. Call 202-224-3121, the U.S. Capitol switchboard. Just tell them your zip code, and they'll transfer you to your representative. B. Write to Office of the Senator, whatever name you have, United States Senate, Washington, D.C., 20510, or to the Office of Representative so-and-so, United States House of Representatives, Washington, D.C., 20515. See, email. For senators, go to www.senate.gov/contacting/indexbystate.cfm. For representatives, go to www.house.gov/writer-rep/. D, send a telegram. Call Western Union, 1-800-325-6000, or visit their website, www.westernunion.com. 2. Dog Bush wherever he goes. If you hear Junior's coming to town, organize a group of friends to protest the event. Remind the media that Bush doesn't govern by the will of the people. Be loud. Be funny. Signs, street theater, mock trials. Show him there's no safe haven from the truth. 3. Force the Democrats to do their job. Obviously, the easiest way to counter the coup is to get the opposition to fight the good fight, but it won't be easy. Today's Democrats have little time for those who can't make their $1,000-a-plate dinners. So, here's how to start a little Democratic behavior modification program. Take the pledge. Go to my website, www.michaelmoore.com, and sign the online petition that challenges the Democrats in Congress to stand up to Bush Cheney and fast, or will work to deny them congressional leadership next year by running Greens in close races where the Democrat's just a Republican in a bad suit. Take over your local Democratic Party. In most counties, the local Democratic Party is run by just a few people because most citizens would never think of showing up. Go to the next county or town party meeting and bring 10 friends. In most cases, your bunch will constitute a majority. Use the rules and state party bylaws, which can often be found on the web, and seize control. 4. You must run for office. That's right, you, the person listening to this book. It's the only way things are ever going to change. Unless normal, decent people run for government office, the job is left to rascals. How can we carp about crooked politicians if we won't do the job ourselves? It's time for you to throw your hat in the ring, and to do it next year. You can run for school board, city council, county treasurer, drain commissioner, city or county clerk, state representative, state senate, state board of education, secretary of state, governor, member of Congress, U.S. senator, even dog catcher, or any number of other offices. The one you should definitely run for is precinct delegate. Every precinct in America elects delegates from each party. It may be the lowliest office, but it's also the foundation on which the whole House of Cards is built. Selected delegates attend the national party conventions to nominate the presidential candidates. You should be among them. And I'm not just saying this. I'm doing it this year and getting a dozen friends to run in their precincts, too. It requires collecting enough signatures to get your name on the ballot, and qualifications vary. But so few people vote in primaries, and so many precincts end up with no candidates, that often getting elected isn't much harder than just showing up. So head down to your Board of Elections or county clerk's office and pick up some petitions before the deadline passes. These are only a few of the measures we can take to stage our counter coup. whether you do it as a Democrat or a Green or just one pissed-off citizen. The important thing is to rise up and do it. Chapter 2. Dear George, an open letter to President George W. Bush. Dear Governor Bush, you and I, we're like family. Our personal connection goes back many years. Neither of us has cared to publicize it for all the obvious reasons, mostly because no one would believe it, but because of something personal, something the Bush family did, my life was profoundly affected. Now, let's come clean and admit it. It was your cousin Kevin who shot Roger and me. At the time I made the movie, I didn't know that your mother and Kevin's mother were sisters. I just thought Kevin, whom I'd met when he was shooting his own film at a cross burning in Michigan, was one of those bohemian artist types that lived in Greenwich Village. Kevin had made a great film, Atomic Cafe, and on a lark, I asked him if he would come to Flint, Michigan, and teach me how to make a movie. To my astonishment, he said yes. And so for 1 week in February of 1987, Kevin Rafferty and Ann Bolin traipsed around Flint with me, showing me how to work the equipment, giving me invaluable tips on how to make a documentary. Without your cousin's generosity, I don't know if Roger and Me would ever have been made. I remember the day your dad was inaugurated as president. I was editing the film in a ratty old editing room in D.C. and decided to go down to watch him be sworn in on the Capitol steps. How weird it was to see your cousin Kevin, my mentor, sitting next to you up on the dais. I remember also walking down the mall and seeing the Beach Boys playing Wouldn't It Be Nice at a free inaugural concert in honor of your father. Back in the editing room, my friend Ben was on the screen, all choked up about going crazy on the assembly line and singing the same Beach Boys song over scenes of Flint in shreds. Months later, when the film was released, your dad, the president, ordered a print of Roger and Me sent to Camp David 1 weekend for the family to watch. Oh, to have been a fly on the wall as you all viewed the havoc and despair that had been visited upon my hometown. Thanks in large part to the actions of Mr. Reagan and your father. Here's something I've always wanted to know. At the end of the film, as the deputy sheriff was tossing the homeless kids' presents and Christmas tree out on the curb because they were $150 behind in their rent, were there any tears in the room? Did anyone feel responsible, or did you all just think, nice camera work, Kev? Well, that was the late 80s. You'd just given up your hard drinking after being sober for a few years. You were trying to find yourself with Dad's help, an oil venture here, a baseball team there. It's been clear to me for some time that you never had any intention of being president yourself. We all stumble into jobs we don't want at one time or another. Who hasn't done that? For you, though, it must be different. After all, it's not just that you don't want to be there now that you're there. You're surrounded by the same gang of geezers who used to run the world with Pops. All those men roaming around the White House, Dick, Rummy, Colin, not a single one is a pal of yours. It's all the old farts Poppy used to have over to the house for a good cigar and vodka as they dreamed up plans to carpet bomb the civilians of Panama. But you're one of us, a boomer, a C student, a partier. What the hell are you doing with that crowd? They're eating you alive and spitting you out like a bad pork rind. They probably didn't tell you that the tax cut they drew up for you to sign was a swindle to take money from the middle class and give it to the super rich. I know you don't need the extra money. You're already set for life thanks to Grandpappy Prescott Bush and his smart trading with the Nazis before and during World War II. During the late 1930s and through the 1940s, Prescott Bush, George I's father and W.'s grandfather, was one of seven directors in the Union Banking Corporation, owned by Nazi industrialists. After filtering their money through a Dutch bank, they hid an estimated $3 million in Bush's bank. As a principal player, it's unlikely that Bush would have been unaware of the Nazi connection. The government eventually seized the assets and the bank dissolved in 1951, after which Prescott Bush and his father, Sam Bush, received $1.5 million. But all those dudes who gave you the record-breaking $190 million to run your campaign, two-thirds of which came from just over 700 individuals, they want it all back and more. They're going to hound you like dogs in heat, making sure you do exactly as they say. Your predecessor may have been renting out the Lincoln bedroom to Barbara Streisand, but that ain't nothing. Before you know it, your pal, acting President Cheney, will be turning over the keys of the West Wing to the chairman of AT&T, Enron, and ExxonMobil. Your critics berate you for taking naps in the middle of the day and ending your workday around 4:30 p.m. You should just tell them you're starting a new American tradition. Lunchtime naps for all and everybody home by 5. Do that and trust me, you'll be remembered as our greatest president. How dare they suggest you're not getting anything done in office? Not true. I've never seen a new president busier than you. It's almost as if you think your days as the man are numbered. With the Senate already gone to the Democrats and the House on its way in 2002, hey, look at the bright side. You'll still have 2 more years before all those sore winners who voted for Gore give you the boot. Your list of accomplishments in just your first few months in office is brutally impressive. You have cut $39 million from federal spending on libraries, cut $35 million in funding for advanced pediatric training for doctors, cut funding for research into renewable energy sources by 50%, delayed rules that would reduce acceptable levels of arsenic in drinking water, cut funding for research into cleaner, more efficient cars and trucks by 28%. Revoked rules strengthening the power of the government to deny contracts to companies that violate federal laws, environmental laws, and workplace safe standards. Allowed Secretary of the Interior Gail Norton to request suggestions for opening up national monuments for foresting, coal mining, and oil and gas drilling. Broken your campaign promise to invest $100 million per year in rainforest conservation. Reduced by 86% the Community Access Program, which coordinated care for people without health insurance among public hospitals, clinics, and other care providers. Nullified a proposal to increase public access to information about the potential ramifications of chemical plant accidents. Cut funding for the Girls and Boys Clubs of America programs in public housing by $60 million. Pulled out of the 1997 Kyoto Protocol Agreement on Global Warming, ultimately signed by 178 other countries. Rejected an international accord to enforce the 1972 treaty banning germ warfare. Cut $200 million from workforce training programs for dislocated workers. Cut $200 million from the Child Care and Development Grant, a program that provides child care to low-income families as they're forced from welfare to work. Eliminated prescription contraceptive coverage to federal employees, though Viagra is still covered. Cut $700 million in funds for public housing repairs, cut $500 million from the Environmental Protection Agency's budget, overturned workplace ergonomic rules designed to protect workers' health and safety, abandoned your campaign pledge to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, a major contributor to global warming, prohibited any federal aid from going to international family planning organizations that provide abortion counseling, referrals, or services with their own funds. Nominated former mining company executive Dan Loriski as Assistant Secretary of Labor for Mine Safety and Health. Appointed Lynn Scarlett, a global warming skeptic and an opponent of stricter standards on air pollution, as Undersecretary of the Interior. Approved Interior Secretary Gail Norton's controversial plan to auction off areas close to Florida's eastern shore for oil and gas development. Announced your plans to allow oil drilling in Montana's Lewis and Clark National Forest. Threatened to shut down the White House AIDS office. Decided no longer to seek guidance from the American Bar Association on federal judicial appointments. Denied college financial aid to students convicted of misdemeanor drug charges, though convicted murderers are still eligible for financial aid. allocated only 3% of the amount requested by Justice Department lawyers in the government's continued litigation against tobacco companies. Push through your tax cut, 43% of which goes to the wealthiest 1% of Americans. Signed a bill making it harder for poor and middle-class Americans to file for bankruptcy, even when facing overwhelming medical bills. Appointed affirmative action opponent K. Cole James to direct the Office of Personnel Management. Cut $15.7 million from programs dealing with child abuse and neglect. Proposed elimination of the Reading is Fundamental program, which gives free books to poor children. Pushed for development of mini-nukes designed to attack deeply buried targets, a violation of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Tried to reverse regulation protecting 60 million acres of national forest from logging and road building. Appointed John Bolton, an opponent of non-proliferation treaties and the United Nations, as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. Made Monsanto Executive Linda Fisher Deputy Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Nominated Michael McConnell, a leading critic of the separation of church and state, to a federal judgeship. Nominated civil rights opponent Terrence Boyle to a federal judgeship. Canceled the 2004 deadline for automakers to develop prototype high-mileage cars. Named John Walters, an ardent opponent of prison drug treatment programs, as drug czar. Appointed oil and coal lobbyist J. Stephen Giles as Deputy Secretary of the Interior. Named Bennett Raley, who has called for the repeal of the Endangered Species Act, as Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Water and Science. Sought the dismissal of a class action lawsuit filed in the United States against Japan by Asian women forced to work as sex slaves in World War II. Appointed as Solicitor General Ted Olson, your chief lawyer in the Florida voting debacle. Proposed to ease the permit process for constructing refineries and nuclear and hydroelectric dams, including lowering environmental standards. Proposed the selling of oil and gas tracts in the Alaska Wildlife Preserve. Phew, I'm tired just reading this list. Where do you get the energy? It is the naps, isn't it? Of course, a lot of the above is supported by many Democrats, and I'll have a few words for them later in the book. But right now I'm concerned about you. Think back. What was your first act as president? You remember? Before you would get in the car to ride down Pennsylvania Avenue in your inaugural parade, you insisted someone get a screwdriver and take the D.C. license plates off the limo because they contained the words, "Support D.C. statehood." Here it is, the biggest day of your life, and you're pissed at the license plates. You have got to relax. I guess, though, I started worrying about you long before that day. A number of disturbing revelations regarding your behavior surfaced during the campaign. Eventually, they went away, but I continue to have concerns about your ability to function on the job. Please don't take this as prying or moralizing. We'll leave that to Cheney. It is simply an honest attempt at intervention from a close friend of the family. Let me be blunt. I'm afraid you may be a threat to our national security. That may be a bit strong, but I don't make this statement lightly. It has nothing to do with our minor disagreements regarding executing innocent people on death row or how much of Alaska to carve up with oil rigs. And I'm not questioning your patriotism. I'm sure you'd love any country that's been this good to you. Rather, it has to do with a number of behaviors many of us who care for you have witnessed over the years. Some of these habits are a little surprising. Some you can't control. And others are, unfortunately, all too common among us Americans. Because you have your finger on the button, you know, the one that would blow up the world, and because decisions you make have vast and far-reaching consequences for the stability of said world, I would like to ask you three pointed questions. And I would like you to give me and the American people three honest answers. One, George, are you able to read and write on an adult level? Oh, it appears to me and many others that, sadly, you may be a functional illiterate. This is nothing to be ashamed of. You have lots of company. Millions of Americans cannot read and write above a fourth grade level. No wonder you said, Leave no child behind. And you know what it felt like. But let me ask this. If you have trouble comprehending the complex position papers you are handed as the leader of the mostly free world, how can we entrust something like our nuclear secrets to you? All the signs of this illiteracy are there, and apparently no one has challenged you about them. The first clue was what you named as your favorite childhood book, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, you said. Unfortunately, that book wasn't even published until a year after you graduated from college. Then there's the question of your college transcripts, if those really are your transcripts. How did you get into Yale when other applicants in 1964 had higher SATs and much better grades? During the campaign, when asked to name the books you were currently reading, you answered gamely. But when quizzed about the book's contents, you didn't know what to say. No wonder your aides stopped letting you hold press conferences with 2 months left in the campaign. Your handlers were scared to death of what you might get asked and how you might answer. One thing is clear to everyone. You can't speak the English language in sentences we can comprehend. At first, the way you mangled words and sentences seemed cute, almost charming. But after a while, it became worrisome. Then, in an interview, you broke America's decades-long policy toward Taiwan, saying we were willing to do whatever it took to defend Taiwan, even suggesting we might deploy troops there. Jeez, George. The whole world flipped out. Before you knew it, everyone was at DEFCON 3. If you're going to be commander-in-chief, you have to be able to communicate your orders. What if these little slip-ups keep happening? Do you know how easy it would be to turn a little faux pas into a national security nightmare? No wonder you want to increase the Pentagon budget. We'll need all that firepower we can get after you accidentally order the Russians wiped out, when what you meant to say was, I need to wipe the Russian dressing off my tie. Your aides have said that you can't read the briefing papers they give you, and that you ask them to read them for you or to you. Your mother was passionately committed to reading programs as First Lady. Should we assume she knew firsthand the difficulty of raising a child who couldn't read? Please, don't take any of this personally. Perhaps it's a learning disability. Some 60 million Americans have learning disabilities. There's no shame in this. Oh, yes, I believe a dyslexic can be president of the United States. Albert Einstein was dyslexic, so is Jay Leno. Hey, I finally found a way to work Leno and Einstein into the same sentence. See, language can be fun. But if you refuse to seek help with this problem, I'm afraid you may be too great a risk for the country. You need help. You need Hooked on Phonics, not just another Oval Office briefing. Tell us the truth, and I'll come to read to you every night at bedtime. 2. Are you an alcoholic? And if so, how is this affecting your performance as Commander-in-Chief? Again, there's no finger being pointed here, no shame or disrespect intended. Alcoholism is a huge problem. It affects millions of American citizens, people we all know and love. Many are able to recover and live normal lives. Alcoholics can be and have been president of the United States. I greatly admire anyone who can deal with this addiction. You've told us that you cannot handle drinking and that you haven't touched a drop of alcohol since you were 40. Congratulations. You have also told us that you used to drink too much and that you eventually realized that alcohol was beginning to crowd out my energies and could crowd eventually my affections for other people. That is the definition of an alcoholic. This does not disqualify you from being president, but it does require that you answer some questions, especially after you spent years covering up the fact that in 1976 you were arrested for drunk driving. Why won't you use the word alcoholic? That is, after all, the first step to recovery. What support system have you set up to make sure you don't fall off the wagon? Being president is perhaps the most stressful job in the world. What have you done to ensure you can handle the pressure and the anxiety associated with being the most powerful man on earth? How do we know you won't turn to the bottle when faced with a serious crisis? You've never had a job like this. For 20 years, from what I can tell, you had no job at all. When you stopped drifting, Your dad set you up in the oil business with some ventures that failed, and then he helped you get a Major League Baseball team, which required you to sit in a box seat and watch a lot of long, slow baseball games. As governor of Texas, you couldn't have had much stress. There isn't enough to do. Being governor of Texas is a relatively ceremonial job. How will you deal with some unexpected new threat to world security? Do you have a sponsor you can call? Is there a meeting you can attend? You don't have to tell me the answers to these questions. You just have to promise me you've thought them out for yourself. I know this is very personal, but the public has a right to know. For those who say, come on, it's his personal life, that was 24 years ago, I have this to say. I was hit by a drunk driver 28 years ago, and to this day, I cannot completely extend my right arm. I'm sorry, George, but when you go out on a public highway drunk, it's no longer just your personal life we're talking about. It's my life and the lives of my family. Your campaign people, the enablers, tried to cover for you, lying to the press about the nature of your arrest for driving under the influence. They said the cop pulled you over because you were driving too slowly. But the arresting officer said it was because you had swerved off on the shoulder of the road. You yourself joined in the denial when asked about the evening you spent in jail. I didn't spend time in jail, you insisted. The officer told the local reporter that, in fact, you were handcuffed, taken to the station, and held in custody for at least an hour and a half. Could it be that you truly don't remember? This is not just some simple traffic ticket. I can't believe your enablers actually implied your drunk driving conviction wasn't as offensive as Clinton's transgressions. Lying about consensual sex you had with another adult while you are married is wrong. But it is not the same as getting behind the wheel of a car when you're drunk and endangering the lives of others, including, George, the life of your own sister, who was with you in the car that night. It is also not the same, despite what your defenders said before the election, as Al Gore volunteering that he smoked pot in his youth. Unless he was driving while stoned, his actions endangered no life but his own. And he wasn't trying to cover it up. You've tried to dismiss the incident by saying it was back in your youth. But you were not a youth. You were in your 30s. The night your conviction was finally revealed to the nation, just days before the election, it was painful to watch you swagger as you tried to chalk up your irresponsible action as the mere youthful indiscretion of having a few beers with the boys. Smirk, smirk. I really felt for the families of the 500,000 people who've been killed by drunks like yourself in the 24 years since your little adventure. Thank God you kept drinking for only another several years after you learned your lesson. I think, too, of what you must have put your wife Laura through. She knew all too well how dangerous it is when any of us get behind the wheel. At 17, she killed a high school friend of hers when she ran through a stop sign and collided with his car. I'm hopeful that you can look to her for guidance if ever you feel the pressures of the job getting to you. Whatever you do, don't turn to Dick Cheney for help. He's had two drunk driving arrests on his record for more than 25 years. Finally, I have to tell you how distressed I was when, back in that crazy week before the election, you hid behind your daughters as your excuse for covering up this conviction. You said you were worried that your history of drunkenness would set a bad example for them. A lot of good that secrecy has done, as proven by the twins' various arrests this year for alcohol possession. In some ways, I admire their rebellion. They asked you, they begged you, they told you, please, Dad, don't run for president and ruin our lives. You did. It did. Now, like all good teenagers, it's payback time. Perhaps the news anchor on Saturday Night Live put it best. George Bush said he didn't reveal the drunk driving charge because of what his daughters might think of him. He had preferred that they think of him as a man with numerous failed business ventures who now executes people. Here's what I suggest. Get help. Join AA. Take your daughters to Al-Anon. You will all be welcomed with open arms. 3. Are you a felon? When you were asked in 1999 about your alleged cocaine use, you replied that you had committed no felonies in the last 25 years. With all we've learned about tricky answers in the last 8 years, that kind of response could only lead a reasonable observer to believe that the years before that were a different story. What felonies did you commit before 1974, George? Believe me, I'm not asking this in order to seek punishment for anything you did. I'm concerned that there is some deep, dark secret you're hiding. You may, in effect, be providing ammunition for anyone who uncovers the secret, be it a foreign power, your current favorite, the Chinese, or domestic, like, pick one, say, R.J. Reynolds. If they discover your history of a felony or felonies, they'll have something to hold over you, putting them in a position to blackmail you. That makes you, George, a national security threat. Trust me, someone will find out what you are hiding, and when they do, we'll all be at risk. You have a duty to disclose the nature of whatever felony you imply that you might have committed. Only by revealing it can you neutralize its potential use as a weapon against you or us. Also, you recently made it a requirement for any young person seeking financial aid for college to answer a question on the application form that reads, "Have you ever been convicted for any drug offense?" If they have, they are denied student aid, which means that many of them will not be going to college. Or, to put it another way, according to your new orders, Sirhan Sirhan can still receive student aid, but a kid with a joint can't. Doesn't this move on your part strike you as a little hypocritical? You would deny college education to thousands of kids who only did exactly what you have implied you did as a young person. Man, that takes some chutzpah. As you'll be receiving $400,000 a year from us until 2004, from the same federal kitty that pays out the college aid, it seems only fair to make you answer the same question. Have you ever been convicted of selling or possessing drugs, not including alcohol or tobacco? We do know, George, that you've been arrested 3 times. Other than some peace activist friends of mine, I don't personally know anyone who has been arrested 3 times in their life. In addition to the drunk driving, you were arrested with some fraternity brothers for stealing a Christmas wreath as a prank. What was that all about? Your third arrest was for disorderly conduct at a football game. Now, this I really don't get. Everyone conducts themselves in a disorderly manner at a football game. I've been to many football games and have had many a beer spilled on my head, but to this day, I've never seen anyone arrested. You got to work pretty hard to get noticed in a crowd of drunken football fans. George, I have a theory about why and how all this happened to you. Now, instead of having to earn it, you have been handed the presidency the same way you've come by everything else in your life. Money and name alone have opened every door for you. Without effort or hard work or intelligence or ingenuity, you have bequeathed a life of privilege. You learned at an early age that in America, all someone like you has to do is show up. You found yourself admitted to an exclusive New England boarding school simply because your name was Bush. You did not have to earn your place there. It was bought for you. When they let you into Yale, you learned you could bypass more deserving students who had worked hard for 12 years to qualify for admission to college. You got in because your name was Bush. You got into Harvard Business School the same way. After screwing off during 4 years at Yale, you took the seat that rightfully belonged to someone else. Then you pretended to serve a full stint in the Texas Air National Guard. But one day, according to the Boston Globe, you just skipped out and failed to report back to your unit for 1.5 years. You didn't have to fulfill your military obligation because your name was Bush. Following the number of lost years that don't appear in your official biography, you were given job after job by your daddy and other family members. No matter how many of your business ventures failed, there was always another one waiting to be handed to you. Finally, you got to be a partner in a Major League Baseball team. Another gift, even though you put up only 1/100th of the money for the team. And then you conned the taxpayers of Arlington, Texas, into giving you another perk. A brand new multi-million dollar stadium that you didn't have to pay for. So it's no wonder you think you deserve to be named president. You didn't earn it or win it. Therefore, it must be yours. And you see nothing wrong with this. Why should you? It's the only life you've ever known. On election night, as the vote swayed back and forth across the nation, you told the press that your brother had assured you Florida was yours. If a Bush said it was so, It was so. But it ain't so. And when it dawned on you that the presidency had to be earned and won by a vote of the people, yes, the people, you went berserk. You sent in hatchet man James Baker. Fuck the Jews, they don't vote for us anyway, was his advice to Poppy in 92. To tell lies to the American people and stoke the nation's fears. When that didn't seem to work, you went to federal court and sued to stop the votes from being counted because you knew how the vote would turn out. If you were truly sure you had the vote of the people, you wouldn't have minded all those votes being counted. What startles me is how you turned to the big, bad federal government for help. Your mantra during every campaign stop was the following. My opponent trusts the federal government. I trust you, the people. Well, we soon learned the truth. You didn't trust the people at all. You went straight to the federal court to get your hand out. Trust the voting machines, not the people. At first, the judges in Florida didn't buy it, and for the first time in your life, someone told you no. But, as we've already seen, Daddy's friends on the U.S. Supreme Court were there to take care of everything. In short, you've been a drunk, a thief, a possible felon, an unconvicted deserter, and a crybaby. You may call the statement cruel. I call it tough love. For the sake of all that is decent and sacred, good God, man, take leave immediately and bring some honor to your all-important family name. Make those of us who know there's a thread of decency in your family proud once again to claim that a bush in the hand is better than a handout to a bush. Yours, Michael Moore. Chapter 3, Dow Wow Wow. As I'm sitting in a Michigan airport waiting for my American Airlines flight to Chicago, a man in a uniform sits down beside me and strikes up a conversation. I learn that he's actually a pilot for American Airlines, or more precisely, American Eagle, the commuter airline of American Airlines, which, like all commuters these days, is now adding jets to its fleets for flights of under 2 hours. This saves the parent company lots of money, I guess. The pilot who has approached me is not scheduled to fly the plane I'm on. He's hoping to grab an empty seat for the flight across Lake Michigan. Do you have to pay to fly if it's a personal trip, I asked. No, he replied. It's about the only fringe benefit we have. He then revealed that the starting pay for a pilot at American Eagle was $16,800 a year. What? I asked, sure that I had misheard the figure. 16 grand per year? That's right, the captain responded, and that's high. At Delta's commuter airlines, starting pay is $15,000 for a pilot. At Continental Express, it's around $13,000. $13,000? For the captain of a commercial airliner? Are you messing with me? No, I'm not messing with anyone. It gets worse. That first year as a pilot, you have to pay for your own flight training and your own uniforms. After that's all deducted, you end up with about $9,000. He paused so that that could sink in. Then he added, gross. I can't believe what I'm hearing. My voice was now getting to a level where others around us began listening in. Believe it, he assured me. One of our pilots last month went down to the welfare office and applied for food stamps. No kidding. With four kids at his level of pay as a pilot, he was legally eligible for assistance. The front office at American found out about this and sent out a memo that said no pilot was to apply for food stamps or welfare, even if they were eligible for it. Anyone who did apply would be let go. So now my buddy just goes down to the food bank on his way home. They don't ask for anything from you that would get back to American Airlines. I thought I'd heard everything by now, but this story was beyond frightening. I did not want to get on that plane. You see, there's something about us humans and our basic animal instincts for survival. And one of those instincts, probably traceable back to the caveman days, is never, ever let someone fly you up in the air who's making less than the kid at Taco Bell. I got on the plane, but only after I convinced myself the guy must have been feeding me a line. How else could I justify risking my life like that? The following week, though, I made some calls and did some research. Much to my horror, that pilot's figures were right. While captains who have been with these commuter airlines for a number of years were pulling in the big money, $40,000 a year, first-year rookies, in many cases, were living below the poverty level. I don't know about you, but I want the people taking me with them to defy nature's most powerful force, gravity, to be happy, content, confident, and well-paid. Even on the big jets for the major airlines, the flight attendants, another group of employees whose training may one day be critical to saving your life, start out at somewhere between $15,000 and $17,000 a year. When I'm at 30,000 feet, I do not want the minds of the pilots or the attendants to be occupied with how they're going to get the heat and lights turned back on once they get home tonight, or which Bob's big boy they're going to have to stick up in order to make the monthly rent. And what's the lesson for the flying public? Be nice to people on welfare. They may be flying you to Buffalo. For the first half of 2001, the pilots for Delta Connection were on strike. The greedy bastards at the union were demanding $20,000 for their pilots' starting pay. But Delta refused, and the work stoppage went on for months. You'd think that considering the booming economy, especially for the well-to-do who fly often, there would be little problem giving the pilots a wage that allows them to subsist on something besides dog food. When boarding a plane, I used to do a sniff check to see if the pilots had been drinking. Now, I'll be looking for stray kibbles or bits as I pass by the cockpit. After begging for scraps from the table, the Delta Connection pilots finally got their $20,000 a year. These pilots and the rest of the public are being told that the economy isn't doing so well, that there's been a huge downturn, that profits are off, that the stock market has taken a beating, and that no matter how far Mr. Greenspan lowers the interest rates, nothing seems to be helping. They certainly have numbers to back up their claim. An average of 403,000 Americans are filing new unemployment claims every week. Hundreds of companies are announcing massive layoffs. Thousands of startups in the new high-tech dot-com fields have gone belly up. Car sales are down. Retailers had a horrible Christmas. From Silicon Alley to Silicon Valley, the belts are being tightened. And we've fallen for it. There is no recession, my friends, no downturn, no hard times. The rich are wallowing in the loot they've accumulated in the past two decades, and now they want to make sure you don't come a-looking for your piece of the pie. The wealthy are doing everything they can to convince you that you'd better not be asking for your share because, well, suddenly there's not enough to go around. Night after night, the media they own tell you one sad story after another about the latest internet company that went down, or mutual fund that lost everything, or NASDAQ investor who went belly up. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost over 300 points. Lucent Technologies announced another 15,000 layoffs. The merger between United and U.S. Airways is off. General Motors is killing off Oldsmobile. And there are now reports that even your personal 401k is not safe. Pretty scary stuff, huh? Oh, it's all true. They wouldn't lie to you. At least not about these puny details they use to manipulate your fears. But what about the bigger lie, the one about how horrible the larger world economy is today? I mean, on one level, it appears to be true. If you're middle class or lower, you have every right to be fearful. Why? Because those on top are even more afraid. They're scared silly that you're going to want to participate in the party they've been having. They're afraid you're going to say, okay, you got your yachts and your homes in the south of France. Now what about me? How about a little something for me? So I can get a new garage door. The only thing bigger than this fear of theirs is their astonishment that none of you have demanded a raise or a vacation or a co-paid visit to the dentist or any share in the excessive wealth that's been generated in the past 10 years. Can it really be that you're content to spend four nights a week wondering who wants to be a millionaire, but never actually answer, me? The corporate poobahs have been waiting for you to drop the other shoe. Yes, those in charge know it's inevitable. One day you're going to want your share. And because that must never happen, the long knives are drawn. And they've decided to perform a preemptive strike in the hope that you'll never even think of eyeing their piles of cash. So that's why they're laying you off or pleading poverty. That's why they've removed the free coffee pot, not because they can't afford the coffee, but because they need to fuck with your mind. They need you in a constant state of stress, suspicion, and fear. You could be next. Forget about the Maxwell House. Save yourselves. The bosses must be sitting back having one of the biggest laughs of their lives. How do I know all this, you ask? Well, you see, I walk among them. I live on the island of Manhattan, a three-mile-wide strip of land that is luxury home and corporate suite to America's elite. Much of the suffering you experience as an American emanates from this piece of platinum real estate nestled between two polluted rivers. Those who run your lives live in my neighborhood. I walk the streets with them every day. I see their children being raised by Haitian immigrants, and I watch them pass by the invisible men who clean the grouting on the marble floors without saying a word, always in a hurry to get to wherever they're going, most likely to reduce your insurance benefits or put your workplace on the chopping block. They are fit, coiffed, and hungry to make a killing, and the next body they drop could be yours. I listen to them talk about how well they've done, the new home in the Berkshires, the trip they just took to Easter Island. They couldn't be happier. When I first moved into my building, it was occupied by artists and playwrights and half the cast of Saturday Night Live. There were hockey guys from the Rangers, a retired NFL player, a cameraman, a few college professors, and some senior citizens. Now, it's pretty much just us. One of the Rangers and my crazy friend Barry, the cinematographer. Everyone else, it seems, is either rich enough to do without a job or busy reaping huge profits from the various properties they own in poor neighborhoods or living off some trust fund or working on Wall Street or from another country here in New York overseeing the family's foreign investments. The Fortune 500 corporations are their bread and butter, and I'm here to tell you they're loaded, and they're not cutting back one bit for themselves. If you don't want to take my word alone, then let me offer you some neutral, objective statistics about just how well those at the top are doing. From 1979 until now, the richest 1% in the country have seen their wages increase by 157%. Those of you in the bottom 20% are actually making $100 less a year, adjusted for inflation, than you were at the dawn of the Reagan era. The world's richest 200 companies have seen their profits grow by 362.4% since 1983. Their combined sales are now higher than the combined gross domestic product of all but 10 nations on Earth. Since the recent mergers of the top four U.S. oil companies, their profits have soared by 146% during what we were told was an energy crisis. In the most recent year for which there are figures, 44 of the top 82 companies in the United States did not pay the standard rate of 35% in taxes that corporations are expected to pay. In fact, 17% of them paid no taxes at all, and seven of these, including General Motors, played the tax code like a harp, juggling business expenses and tax credits until the government actually owed them millions of dollars. Another 1,279 corporations with assets of $250 million or more also paid no taxes and reported no income for 1995, the most recent year for which statistics are available. We are getting bilked in so many ways that listing them all might get me charged with inciting a riot. But who cares? Mercedes-Benz, which has continually refused to meet American mileage and pollution standards, was being fined for its lawbreaking when it came up with an ingenious plan. For the years 1988 and 1989, the company deducted from their taxes the $65 million it had paid in fines as ordinary expenses incurred in carrying on its trade or business. That means that you and I paid $65 million so that a bunch of rich people could drive around in big fancy cars and ruin our lungs. Fortunately, the IRS was onto this scam and denied their claim. Halliburton, the oil company, set up a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands in the early 90s. Problem is, there is no oil in the Cayman Islands. Nor are there any oil refineries or distribution centers. So what was that Halliburton subsidiary doing there? Evidently, the government was suspicious. From 1996 until 1998, 14 separate tax actions were filed against Halliburton entities. In one case, The government contended that Halliburton used these subs to avoid $38 million in taxes. Most of these cases have been resolved. They aren't the only ones interested in defrauding the federal government. A half dozen major U.S. insurance companies now call Bermuda their headquarters, including insurance giants Chubb, Hartford, Kemper, Liberty, Mutual, and others. Accenture, which used to be known as Anderson Consulting, recently moved its company to Bermuda in order to avoid paying taxes. It's really just a paper move. They still have all their offices around the country, and everyone shows up to work every day doing what they always did for Anderson. It's just their headquarters that have moved. Wouldn't you love to wake up tomorrow and declare that you've moved yourself to Fiji, even though you still have to look at Topeka outside your window? Forbes magazine estimates that corporate tax shelters cost us average Americans over $10 billion a year, and we have to make up the difference by paying more taxes or by losing services. Next time you can't afford to fix the furnace or replace the computer, you can thank all those fat cats who've got you repeating the line, "The economy isn't doing too well right now." Instead of collecting this money that's being stolen from us, how is the IRS spending its time these days? They've decided to go after you. That's right. They've thrown up the white flag. They're surrendering their efforts to get the rich to pay their taxes. Their new policy is to focus on squeezing those who make the least. According to the General Accounting Office, those who earn less than $25,000 a year have seen their IRS audits double, while those earning over $100,000 have seen their audits drop by over 25%. What does this mean on the balance sheet? It's resulted in a drop of 26% in the amount of taxes corporations pay, while you, the average American, have seen your taxes go up by at least 13%. In the 1950s, taxes from corporations made up 27% of the revenues for the federal government. Today, that number has dropped to less than 10%. Who has made up the difference? You and your second job. Part of the reason you're hearing so much about how bad the economy is these days is that many of those who are getting their pink slips are the friends and family of those reporting the bad news. Unlike the massive layoffs of the 80s, which were all but ignored by those who went to good colleges and made good money, the layoff massacres today are mostly white-collar and professional. Lay off a few hundred thousand of these people, and you're going to hear about it. Why? Well, because it's so unfair. I mean, these high-tech guys paid their dues. They played by the rules, gave their heart and soul and first marriage to the company. They were there for every company retreat, never missed a late-night think session, attended every charity event the chairman and his friends threw. And then one day, "Bob, this is an employment counselor we've hired to help you with your transition, which we'd like to make as easy for you as possible. Please hand me your keys, and this gentleman with the badge and gun will escort you to your cubicle so you can collect your personal belongings and leave the building in the next 12 minutes. There is no downturn. Are businesses earning less than last year? Absolutely. How could they not? The 90s saw these corporations post surreal, over-the-top profits, a once-in-a-lifetime bonanza that had nothing to do with reality. Compare any year's figures to those, and you're comparing apples and windfalls. There was a headline the other day that said GM's profits were down 73% from last year. That sounds bad. But last year was nothing short of a profit orgy. Even with that 73% drop, GM will still pocket over $800 million profit in the first half of 2001. Are dot-coms folding left and right? Of course they are. Big deal. That's what happens with any new revolutionary invention. A ton of entrepreneurs hop on board to find their fortune, and in the end, only the mediocre but ruthless few are still standing. It's called capitalism. In 1919, 20 years after the invention of the automobile, there were 108 automobile manufacturers in the United States. 10 years later, the number had whittled down to the big 44 U.S. auto companies. By the end of the 50s, it dropped to 8. And today, we have a grand total of 2.5 U.S. car manufacturers. That's the way it works in our system. You don't like it? You can move to, where do you move these days? Oh, of course, Bermuda. Chapter 4, Kill Whitey. I don't know what it is, but every time I see a white guy walking toward me, I tense up. My heart starts racing, and I immediately begin to look for an escape route and a means to defend myself. I kick myself for even being in this part of town after dark. Didn't I notice the suspicious gangs of white people lurking on every street corner, drinking Starbucks and wearing their gang colors of Gap turquoise or J. Crew mauve? What an idiot. Now the white person is coming closer, closer. And then, he walks by without harming me, and I breathe a sigh of relief. White people scare the crap out of me. This may be hard for you to understand, considering that I am white. But then again, my color gives me a certain insight. For instance, I find myself pretty scary a lot of the time, so I know what I'm talking about. You can take my word for it. If you can find yourself suddenly surrounded by white people, you better watch out. Anything can happen. As white people, we've been lulled into thinking it's safe to be around other white people. We've been taught since birth that it's the people of that other color we need to fear. They're the ones who'll slit your throat. Yet, as I look back on my life, a strange but unmistakable pattern seems to emerge. Every person who has ever harmed me in my lifetime, the boss who fired me, the teacher who flunked me, the principal who punished me, the kid who hit me in the eye with a rock, the other kid who shot me with his BB gun, the executive who didn't renew TV Nation, the guy who was stalking me for 3 years, the accountant who double-paid my taxes, the drunk who smashed into me, the burglar who stole my stereo, the contractor who overcharged me, the girlfriend who left me, the next girlfriend who left me even sooner, the pilot of the plane I was on who hit a truck on the runway, he probably hadn't eaten in days, the other pilot who decided to fly through a tornado, the person in the office who stole checks from my checkbook and wrote them out to himself for a total of $16,000, every one of these individuals has been a white person. Coincidence? I think not. I have never been attacked by a black person, never been evicted by a black person, never had my security deposit ripped off by a black landlord, never had a black landlord, never had a meeting at a Hollywood studio with a black executive in charge, never seen a black agent at the film TV agency that used to represent me, never had a black person deny my child the college of her choice, never been puked on by a black teenager at a Motley Crue concert, never been pulled over by a black cop, never been sold a lemon by a black car salesman, never seen a black car salesman, never had a black person deny me a bank loan, never had a black person try to bury my movie, and I've never heard a black person say, "We're going to eliminate 10,000 jobs here. Have a nice day." I don't think I'm the only white guy who can make these claims. Every mean word, every cruel act, every bit of pain and suffering in my life has had a Caucasian face attached to it. So, what is it exactly that I should be afraid of black people? I look around at the world I live in, and folks, I hate to tell tales out of school, but it's not the African Americans who have made this planet such a pitiful, scary place to inhabit. Recently, a headline in the front page of the science section of the New York Times asked the question, "Who built the H-bomb?" The article went on to discuss a dispute that has arisen between the men who claim credit for making the first bomb. Frankly, I could have cared less, because I already know the only pertinent answer. It was a white guy. No black guy ever built or used a bomb designed to wipe out hordes of innocent people, whether in Oklahoma City, Columbine, or Hiroshima. No, my friends, it's always the white guy. Let's go to the tote board. Who gave us the black plague? A white guy. Who invented PBC, PVC, PVB, and a host of chemicals that are killing us? White guys. Who has started every war America has been in? White men. Who is responsible for the programming on Fox? White men. Who invented the punch card ballot? A white man. Whose idea was it to pollute the world with the internal combustion engine? Whitey, that's who. The Holocaust? That guy really gave white people a bad name. That's why we prefer to call him a Nazi and his little helpers Germans. The genocide of Native Americans? White men. Slavery? Whitey. So far in 2001, American companies have laid off over 700,000 people. Who ordered the layoffs? White CEOs. Who keeps bumping me off the internet? Some friggin' white guy, and if I find him, he's a dead white guy. You name the problem, the disease, the human suffering, or the abject misery visited upon millions, and I'll bet you $10 I can put a white face on it faster than you can name the members of NSYNC. And yet, when I turn on the news each night, what do I see again and again? Black men alleged to be killing, raping, mugging, stabbing, gangbanging, looting, rioting, selling drugs, pimping, hoeing, having too many babies, dropping babies from tenement windows, fatherless, motherless, godless, penniless. The suspect is described as a black male. The suspect is described as a black male. The subject is described as a black male. No matter what city I'm in, the news is always the same. The suspect always the same unidentified black male. I'm in Atlanta tonight, and I swear the police sketch of the black male suspect on TV looks just like the black male suspect I saw on the news last night in Denver and the night before in L.A. In every sketch, he's frowning, he's menacing, and he's wearing the same knit cap. Is it possible that it's the same black guy committing every crime in America? I believe we've become so used to this image of the black man as predator that we are forever ruined by this brainwashing. In my first film, Roger and Me, a white woman on Social Security clubs a bunny rabbit to death so she can sell him as meat instead of as a pet. I wish I had a nickel for every time in the last 10 years someone has come up to me and told me how horrified and shocked they were when they saw that poor little cute bunny bonked on the head. The scene, they say, made them physically sick. Some had to turn away or leave the theater. Many wondered why I would include such a scene. The Motion Picture Association of America gave Roger and Me an R rating in response to that rabbit killing, which compelled 60 Minutes to do a story on the stupidity of the rating system. Teachers write me and say they have to edit that part out of the film so they won't get in trouble for showing my movie to their students. But less than 2 minutes after the bunny lady does her deed, I included footage of a scene in which the police in Flint opened fire and shot a black man who was wearing a Superman cape and holding a plastic toy gun. Not once, not ever, has anyone said to me, "I can't believe you showed a black man being shot in your movie. How horrible, how disgusting. I couldn't sleep for weeks." After all, he was just a black man, not a cute, cuddly bunny. There's no outrage at showing a black man being shot on camera, least of all from the MPAA ratings board, who saw absolutely nothing wrong with that scene. Why? Because a black man being shot is no longer shocking. Just the opposite. It's normal. Natural. We become so accustomed to seeing black men killed in the movies and in the evening news that we now accept it as standard operating procedure. No big deal. Just another dead black guy. That's what blacks do. Kill and die. Oh, hum, pass the butter. It's odd that despite the fact that most crimes are committed by whites, black faces are usually attached to what we think of as crime. Ask any white person who they fear might break into their home or harm them in the street, and if they're honest, they'll admit that the person they have in mind doesn't look much like them. The imaginary criminal in their heads looks like Mookie or Hakim or Kareem, not little freckle-faced Jimmy. How does the brain process a fear like this when everything it sees says the opposite? Are white people's brains hardwired to see one thing but believe the opposite because of race? If that's the case, then do all white people suffer from some shared low-grade mental illness? If every time the sun was out, it was nice and bright and clear, but your brain told you to stay inside because it definitely looked like a storm was brewing, well, we might encourage you to seek some professional help. Are white people who see black boogeymen around every corner any different? Obviously, no matter how many times their fellow whites make it clear that the white man is the one to fear, it simply fails to register. Every time you turn on the TV to news of another school shooting, it's always a white kid who's conducting the massacre. Every time they catch a serial killer, it's a crazy white guy. Every time a terrorist blows up a federal building, or a madman gets 400 people to drink Kool-Aid, or a Beach Boys songwriter casts a spell causing half a dozen nymphets to murder all the piggies in the Hollywood Hills, You know it's a member of the white race up to his old tricks. So why don't we run like hell when we see Whitey coming toward us? Why don't we ever greet the Caucasian job applicant with, "Gee, I'm sorry, there aren't any positions available right now." Why aren't we worried sick about our daughters marrying white guys? And why isn't Congress trying to ban the scary and offensive lyrics of Johnny Cash? "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. The Dixie Chicks, Earl had to die." Or Bruce Springsteen, "I killed everything in my path. I can't say that I'm sorry for the things that we've done." Why all the focus on rap lyrics? Why doesn't the media print rap lyrics like these and tell the truth? "I sold bottles of sorrow, then chose poems and novels. Wu-Tang Clan. People use your brain to gain. Ice Cube. A poor mother on welfare, tell me how you did it. Tupac Shakur. I'm trying to change my life. See, I don't want to die a sinner. Master P." African Americans have been on the lowest rung of the economic ladder since the day they were beaten and dragged here in chains. And they have never made it off that rung, not for a single damn day. Every other immigrant group who has landed here has been able to advance from the bottom to the middle and upper levels of our society. Even Native Americans, who are among the poorest of the poor, have fewer children living in poverty than African Americans. You probably thought things had gotten better for blacks in this country. I mean, after all, considering all the advances we've made eliminating racism in our society, one would think our black citizens might have seen their standard of living rise. A survey published in the Washington Post in July 2001 showed that 40 to 60% of white people thought the average black person had it as good or better than the average white person. Think again. According to a study conducted by the economists Richard Vedder, Lowell Galloway, and David C. Klingemann, the average income for a black American is 61% less per year than the average white income. That is the same percentage difference as it was in 1880. Not a damn thing has changed in more than 120 years. Want more proof? Consider the following. About 20% of young black men between the ages of 16 and 24 are neither in school nor working, compared with only 9% of young white men. Despite the economic boom of the 90s, this percentage has not fallen substantially over the last 10 years. In 1993, white households had invested nearly three times as much in stocks and mutual funds and or IRA and KEO accounts as black households. Since then, the stock market has more than doubled its value.